Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're getting into something that sounds kind of abstract, but it's basically the global equivalent of a country's credit card bill.
We're talking about the current account deficit, or CAD.
Exactly. And our mission for this deep dive is to take these really detailed academic notes from a seminar on how countries fix these things and just break down the tools they use to keep their economies from, going off a cliff.
And it's so critical because when a major economy's external balance gets out of whack, it creates these shockwaves that affect all of us through global trade, through finance.
So we've got the data, we've got the policy ideas, and case studies from all over.
Yeah, from places like Vietnam and Thailand, all the way to, the biggest economy in the world.
And that's really where we have to start, with this huge structural problem in global finance today. According to our sources, the U.S. current account deficit is running at about 4% of GDP.
Which is massive.
Yeah.
And it leads to this paradox.
The U.S. dollar catch 22.
That's it. To actually fix the deficit, to make U.S. exports cheaper and imports more expensive, you need the dollar to get weaker.
But.
But to finance that deficit, and we're talking about needing to attract something like $2 billion a day in foreign capital, the dollar has to be strong.
So it needs to be weak to fix the problem, but strong to keep the system from collapsing while the problem exists.
It's a fundamental tension, and governments are constantly wrestling with it.
Okay, so let's unpack this a bit. The current account balance, the CA. What fundamentally is in that bucket? It's not just about trading goods, is it?
No, it's much, much broader than that. The current account is really a full summary of all of a country's non-financial dealings with the rest of the world.
So it's a few different things added together.
Right. You start with the most obvious one, the trade balance. That's just your exports of physical goods minus your imports of goods.
Okay, straightforward enough.
Then you add in non-financial services. Think tourism, consulting, things like that.
And then there's income.
Exactly, investment income. So, profits and dividends your citizens earn from their investments abroad, minus the interest payments you have to make to foreigners who've invested in your country,
And a last piece.
is unrequited transfers. It's usually the smallest part. Think foreign aid or money that migrant workers send back home to their families.
So if you add all that up and the number is negative, you've got a current account deficit. And our sources really stress two ways to measure how, I guess, dangerous that deficit is.
The first is just the deficit as a percentage of your GDP, but the second one is maybe more interesting. It's the trade openness ratio.
Right, so that's exports plus imports, all divided by GDP.
And this one metric tells you so much about how exposed a country is to global
Yeah,
shocks.
the chart in our materials is pretty stark. You have the U.S. and Japan, which are, relatively closed economies. Their openness is maybe 20, 30%.
They can absorb a global downturn a lot more easily.
But then you look at Singapore or Hong Kong, and their trade openness is over 300% of their GDP.
It's just off the charts. And that extreme dependence, it creates volatility. We see it with a country like Thailand. They're massively dependent on global trade. So when there's a global recession or even just a slowdown with a major trading partner, their GDP gets hit so much harder than a country like the US. It's a totally different risk profile.
Okay, so a country finds itself with one of these persistent deficits. What's actually causing it? The sources point to four main drivers. Let's start with just the speed of the economy.
Right. The first one is what we can call the overheating factor. It's just national income variation.
Meaning, if your economy is growing a lot faster than everyone else's.
Exactly. Your people feel wealthier, they have more income, and they just naturally start demanding more stuff from other countries, more imports. The U.S. is the textbook case for this. When the U.S. economy is strong, that growth almost always widens the current account deficit.
Okay, that makes sense. The second factor is about prices, inflation, and competitiveness.
This one's pretty intuitive. It's all about relative costs. If your domestic inflation is running hotter than your trading partners, your exports start to look really expensive to the rest of the world.
And at the same time, foreign goods look cheaper to your own citizens.
Precisely. So you export less and you import more. High inflation directly wears away at your trade balance.
And then we get to factor three, which is the classic twin deficits problem.
This is when you have what economists call excessive absorption at home.
Meaning everyone, both private consumers and the government, is spending way too much.
Yeah, the country is basically living beyond its collective means, and that overheating often creates the two deficits at the same time. A fiscal deficit, because the government is overspending, and a current account deficit, because the nation as a whole is buying too much from abroad.
You know, it's interesting the sources bring up China in this context, because traditionally, China has run huge fiscal deficits, but has also had these massive trade surpluses. How does that fit?
That's a fantastic point, and it shows the model isn't universal. The theory assumes high government spending crowds out savings, which then triggers the current account deficit.
But in China's case?
In China's case, you have an enormous domestic savings rate that more than offsets the government spending. So it just goes to show that what really matters is the overall balance of savings versus investment and consumption in the economy.
Okay, and the final driver is the most direct one, government restrictions.
Yep. This is policy designed to shape trade flows. You have tariffs, which are just taxes on imports to make them more expensive.
Like the U.S. tariffs on apparel or farm products.
Exactly. And then you have the sneakier ones, the non-tariff barriers, or NTBs, things like import quotas or really specific health and safety regulations.
The banana war example in the notes is wild.
It is. It shows how these political fights over things like, well, banana import rules in Europe can lead to millions of dollars in authorized sanctions and directly shift the current account balance.
So a government sees this deficit getting out of control. They have to act. And the goal, as you said, is pretty painful. They have to cool down the economy.
They have to reduce that domestic absorption and try to boost national savings. It's a menu of really tough choices. Every single tool has a trade-off.
So let's run through the toolkit. It looks like the first options are about creating some pain internally, monetary and fiscal policy.
That's right. The quickest fixes. First, tight monetary policy. That means hiking interest rates, making it more expensive to borrow. It slows down spending.
And second, tight fiscal policy.
Slashing government spending or raising taxes. Both of those tools are designed to pull demand out of the economy almost immediately.
But they're politically brutal. I mean, nobody wins an election by promising higher interest rates and higher taxes.
Yep.
You're basically guaranteeing a slowdown, maybe even a recession.
And that's the rub. The source materials are explicit about this. One of the main tools is reducing private and public consumption, but it comes with the warning. At the risk of killing growth.
It's a terrible choice to have to make.
It is. Then you have the big one we'll get into next, which is exchange rate adjustment. Using your currency to try and fix the imbalance.
And then there are the long-term, more structural fixes.
Right. Things that take years to pay off, like boosting your country's productivity and competitiveness, or trying to diversify your trade partners and substitute imports with domestic goods.
Like we're seeing being pushed in places like Argentina right now.
Exactly. But all of these policies, every single one, they all boil down to fixing one fundamental equation.
The investment savings link.
That's the core of it. If your national investment is higher than your national savings, you will have a current account deficit. You have to borrow that difference from the rest of the world to fund your ambitions.
That chart for Thailand in the notes makes it so clear. And that's been the story for the U.S. for decades, right? Investment has consistently been higher than savings.
Since 1980, pretty consistently. A structural deficit funded by the rest of the world.
Okay, let's zero in on that exchange rate lever. It feels like the most powerful tool. In theory, it's simple. You weaken your currency, a devaluation.
And your exports instantly get cheaper for foreigners, and imports get more expensive for your own people. Problem solved.
We even saw it work, right? In the mid-2000s, the dollar got weaker against the euro, and it led to a bit of an export-led recovery for the U.S.
It did. And that's why you hear political leaders complain that other currencies, like the yuan or the euro, are too weak. They're worried about losing that competitive edge.
But the sources here are pretty clear that it's not that simple. Devaluation often doesn't work the way you'd expect. There are four big reasons why.
This is where the messy reality of global trade crashes into clean economic theory. First, your competitors don't just stand still. Foreign companies will often cut their own prices just to hold on to their market share.
So the price of imports for your consumers doesn't actually go up as much as the currency change would suggest.
Exactly. Second, other countries might devalue their currencies right back at you to stay competitive.
So it becomes a race to the bottom. And nobody gained anything.
A zero-sum game. Third, there's a huge time lag. International trade runs on contracts that are set months, sometimes over a year, in advance. It can take 18 months or more for the price changes to really filter through the system.
And the fourth reason is the one that really surprised me. Intracompany trade.
It's huge. About half of all international trade is just big multinational corporations shipping parts and products between their own subsidiaries in different countries.
And the prices they use for those transfers aren't nearly as sensitive to daily currency swings.
Not at all. And all these delays, they lead directly to this famous phenomenon in economics.
The J curve.
The J curve. You devalue your currency today, but because of those locked-in contracts and slow reactions, your import bill actually goes up at first, and the deficit gets worse.
It deepens.
Only later, over many months, as trade volumes finally adjust, does the balance curve back up towards a surplus. It creates that J shape on a graph.
So for any of this to work at all, there's a fundamental condition that has to be met. People have to actually care about the price changes.
That is the absolute core of it. It's called the Marshall-Lerner condition.
And it basically says?
It says that a devaluation will only improve your trade balance if the demand for your exports and imports is elastic. Meaning, if the price changes, people have to actually change how much they buy. Mm-hmm.
If your imports are things you absolutely have to buy, no matter the cost, like, say, energy or critical medicines, then making them more expensive doesn't reduce the quantity you buy.
And your trade balance doesn't improve. The currency tool is useless.
Okay, so to really understand competitiveness, we have to look deeper than just the daily exchange rate you see on the news. We need to talk about the real exchange rate.
Yes, the RER. This is the rate that matters. It's the nominal rate, but adjusted for the inflation difference between you and your trading partner. It's the only way to compare apples to apples.
So a country's currency could stay flat, but if its inflation is soaring, its exports are actually getting more expensive in real terms.
Exactly. It's losing competitiveness, even if the nominal rate hasn't moved.
And when you average this out against all of your main trading partners, you get the RER, the real effective exchange rate.
That's the number. That's the true scorecard for a country's competitiveness that policymakers are watching. It's what underpins those simpler measures you see, like the Big Mac Index, which is really just a fun way of looking at purchasing power parity.
So let's connect that to the prices we actually pay through this idea of exchange rate pass-through.
Right. The question is, if the currency moves by 10%, how much of that change actually shows up in the final price of an imported car or TV?
And the sources say that pass-through is often incomplete.
Very incomplete, especially in developed economies like the United States. Import prices there have become much less sensitive to currency swings over time.
Which brings us full circle to that big puzzle. Why has the dollar weakening over the years had so little effect on fixing the huge U.S. current account deficit?
There are a few really powerful structural reasons. First, so much of global trade is invoiced in dollars anyway, so the exchange rate matters less. But second, foreign companies are just desperate to keep their market share in the U.S.
So they just eat the cost.
They absorb the weaker dollar into their profit margins instead of raising prices for American consumers.
And then there's the fact that so much of the final sticker price is actually just domestic U.S. costs.
Right. Marketing, shipping from the port, the dealer's markup, none of that is affected by the exchange rate.
All of this just locks in the fundamental U.S. current account dilemma.
It's a structural trap.
Right.
To shrink the deficit, you need a weak dollar. But to fund the deficit, to attract that $2 billion a day, you need a strong dollar.
And the whole system just seems to depend on the goodwill of foreign investors. There's that Morgan Stanley quote in the notes.
That the deficit isn't worrying as long as Asia continues to park its capital surpluses in U.S. assets.
Given that 60% of the U.S. deficit is with Asia and is largely funded by their central banks buying U.S. debt, that feels like a massive, massive risk just sitting there.
A huge risk of capital repatriation, yes.
So this whole deep dive really shows there are no easy answers here. Adjusting a current account deficit isn't about finding a magic bullet. It's about choosing your poison.
It is. Do you want the pain of tight monetary policy or fiscal cuts or the unpredictability of currency manipulation? Each one comes at a cost, and that cost is usually domestic growth.
And that lesson about the exchange rate is really sobering. Even that powerful lever can be neutralized by consumer behavior or lack thereof, and just the basic structure of modern global trade.
That incomplete pass-through is a huge deal.
But we did see some success stories. Vietnam's turnaround was incredible, going from a 12% deficit to a 6% surplus.
It shows that with really tough, committed policies, you can engineer a massive change. It's a stark contrast to places like Greece, which struggled for years with chronic deficits. The policy choices really do matter.
So we'll leave you with this final thought to chew on. If the global system requires the U.S. to have a strong dollar to attract the capital it needs to finance its spending, does that mean the U.S. is structurally incentivized not to fix its deficit? What are the long-term consequences when the entire world's financial stability relies on foreign capital continuing to fund a gap created by American consumption?
It's a huge liability, hiding in plain sight.
Something to think about until our next deep dive.